the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked.
In this October 2016 edition, we focus on social justice with Dr. Maria Hess. Maria is currently serving as the Executive and Clinical Director of Humanidad Therapy and Education Services. She was the co-founder and clinical director of Lomi Community Clinic and of Sonoma County's first forensic marriage and family therapist training program. In 2012, Maria was approached by a Sonoma County family attorney and asked to develop a program for court-affiliated services such as supervised visitation, therapeutic supervised visitation, and meditation. These services were to be targeted towards the bilingual, multicultural community, who in many cases would not be eligible for assistance. Maria had a vision for providing culturally sensitive therapists and set about the task of securing counseling students from universities in the Bay Area to serve the community. Maria has been a leader in the movement dedicated to exploring trauma-informed care and vicarious trauma in Sonoma County schools. Maria is also professor at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California, and a board member of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, which produces Education Now. Welcome, Maria. It is such an honor to talk with you on the subject of trauma-informed care at schools in Sonoma County, California.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to have this discussion about something that's just so big and so pertinent to us. So I'm grateful to be able to share the information.
Well, let's just jump right in. Trauma-informed care. Why is it so important in achieving social justice?
Well, so I was thinking about this in so many different ways. This is such a big topic, and so I was thinking, okay, well, what's the best thing to really talk about? So I wanted to start with talking about the outcome and the benefits for why a trauma-informed school, right, that would hold these premises of how do we change our ideas about children on campuses that are high risk, high trauma, high volatility, and then also taking a look at that in our teachers. So I want to go back and forth between this. But first, let me start out with the benefits. So what we've been seeing, and this is nationally, and I belong to some like blogs for trauma-informed care folks, mostly around the mindfulness movement internationally. And we're hearing such wonderful outcomes. For example, improved academic achievement and test scores, improved overall school climate where people are happier, they feel safer, they're more engaged, an improved teacher's sense of satisfaction and safety in being in the classroom. So I often hear from teachers, well, I don't know if the kids are getting too much out of mindfulness, but I feel great. So what we're seeing are people feeling more grounded, more less frightened of behaviors that, you know, we're seeing more and more on campuses, which is so interesting given how we're learning so much and still the data shows a rise in disruptive behaviors, drops in school. So these trauma-informed methods that I'm going to be talking to you about really affect the reduction of stress for staff, the reduction of student referrals, the reduction in absences, bullying, harassment, I mean, on and on. So that's the good news.
So it has empowered students and families and communities.
I would say that it lights up the personal power that's already there, but that has been, truncated or oppressed or however you want to talk about it, because of the level of fear people have about being stigmatized with mental health issues or feeling blamed from a cultural perspective. So let me get into this just a little bit. Is that okay?
Oh, go. Just dig right in.
Okie doke. So, most of us in academia now, I would guess, have heard about the Adverse Childhood Experience study from Dr. Folletti and Anda in San Diego that was done in the late 1990s. And as a result of his, it was an experiment, but accidental, right, that were almost 18,000 volunteers from the Kaiser Permanente, and they did a questionnaire about people's, their family life and the trauma responses in family life. So that started a big aha and big question in the National Institute on Mental Health. And so they continued to do research and really look at how the statistics were about mental illness and mental health. And what they came out with in, 2014, was the statistic that 1 in 4 students have some form of mental illness. Now, 1 in 4. Now, and some people who report that number thought that it was underreported. So if we think about what we're looking in the classroom, ADHD, depression, anxiety, inability to concentrate, and all kinds of depression, panic disorders, sleep disorders, we're seeing a lot of it, eating disorders, cutting, family disruptions of all kinds, domestic violence, addiction. So it's not hard to imagine 1 in 4. But what happens then is that, teachers are not, unless you're teaching psychology or teaching people to be therapists, they're not therapists and they're not educated in trauma. So you get this rise in, the disruptions it's a disruption in mental wellness is really how I think of it. I have a little trouble with some of these labels, but because they're part of our cultural nomenclature, I feel like I have to use it to describe what I'm talking about. There was many schools, one in Compton, one in San Francisco Marina Middle School, where we, myself and the principal at the time of Cook Middle School, we went to go visit and to talk about the impact of mindfulness, which is the other method of and outcome that I'll talk about as we move along. And really showed how when teachers got really anchored to themselves, knew themselves, were not triggered by the children, didn't personalize what they did, and that they could see their behaviors in the classroom that are typically and normally classified as disruptive, problem, bad, instead of looking at it that way, to take a look at it as a bid for contact, that because their amygdalas are overstimulated by an appropriate trauma response of fight, flight, or freeze, the frontal cortex can't light up and do the learning and the self-regulation. And if we also then, correlate the developmental material, what we're seeing is that the brain has a lot longer growing and, for lack of a better word, fermenting into intellect, right, and common sense and being able to go, it's not appropriate to say these things in public and be able to hold back appropriately. Those things are not available to elementary, middle school, and depending on the trauma response of their family and what they're living in, on into high school and early adulthood. So some of what we see then are children who just cannot sit still, keep their hands to themselves, elicit any kind of respectful response. And you can imagine, and I'm sure any teacher that is listening to this can also say hallelujah, that you have to do a certain amount of personal work to not respond just in a reactive way. Because, I mean, you know, we all have our breaking points, and when you're, you know, you have 5 and 6 periods of children that cannot self-regulate and cannot moderate, it gets tiring and it gets old. And it's dispiriting. So that's the long introduction to how this even came about, was just the awareness that, whoa, we're not able to teach because there's something going on with our students that is not allowing them to learn. Also, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, but in my own worldview, as I'm noticing how the world is changing and I'm putting more attention to really examining, what is this about? How do we really grab a hold of the core of this? It would be difficult, I think, to ignore the socio-political justice ideas and mentalities of our culture. And if we, and maybe I should start personalizing this, because I don't want to diminish the importance of this by generalizing. So right now, we've, Humanidad Therapy and Education, we've been at Cook Middle School probably now for, this is our 6th semester, our 3rd year. We were invited to go there and to really assess for climate wellness and what needed to happen at that school. And as we started to really get into it, what we really saw were layers upon layer of trauma. Trauma from being in the barrio, trauma from the pressures of racism and unconscious bias and systemic inequities that really create a system of poverty and inequity as far as access. And a level of fear, right, because their lives are so unpredictable. Who's going to be in the home? Who's going to stay in the home? How safe are they in the home? All these kinds of environmental, social, political, psychological, economic influences come onto the school campus with every child, every staff member, and every faculty member, not to mention administration and consultants, all of us, you know, we bring the baggage with us. So when there's an unconscious trigger in the campus or on the campus, for example, maybe some talk about a fight that's going to happen off campus, or somebody who comes and starts talking about gang affiliation on one side or another can create a tension. Because it stimulates that, you know, there's a danger. It really gets that amygdala, autonomic nervous system going. And so children, it's just underdeveloped, and they don't know how to deal with stress and, you know, diets and what they are eating, what they aren't eating, all of that is so part of the picture. But I think another piece that's been formerly, at least in from my view, unexamined thoroughly enough, is the undone world of the teacher. Because if the teacher is triggered by students, then the propensity to give back what they're getting and be reactive rather than reparative or, you know, compassionate with empathy, drops significantly, because if you're not conscious about what's going on, you just do what you know. So now, again, this is not about blaming anybody. It's about finding a way to try and understand the pieces that create these difficulties on our campuses and disallow our children to get what they need to grow into responsible human beings. But also, it speaks to the importance of how we need each other to connect. So if we're looking at families that have high social poverty and other social constraints for success, teachers, counselors, staff become some of the role models that the parents cannot give because of their responsibilities to keep the family going. So if we can't remember to have empathy for that, ourselves as educators, it becomes really complicated on the campus. There's more blaming. And you know, teachers feel bad. They blame themselves. They feel guilty. They feel helpless and hopeless. And trauma-informed care has given a way for them to get off the hook, to do some of the interpersonal stuff that they need to do, to change how they are in the classroom. And it also helps develop empathy. And we know that, you know, empathy fuels compassion. And the experience of compassion in the newest research is showing how it improves stress reduction and a calming effect, so that teachers can take a step back and be the role models and the, you know, the leaders that they got into the profession to be.
Yes.
You know, I just read a ton of stuff.
Oh, that's wonderful. I couldn't agree with you more. So it what you're doing has empowered students, families, communities, and teachers. And you're to take this on and with a change in attitude. Now, I know that in a good teacher training programs, reflective listening is a part of the training.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
And so, you know, that teachers, you know, that don't have that skill, that is a primary skill for not being reactive, but being reflective.
Yeah.
And then the arts, are they serving their purpose in these schools, you know, as expressive tools for children who have emotional, you know, well, all of us need to express our inner selves, but especially children who have trauma in their lives need venues of expression. Are these available to these children at these schools where you're working, Maria?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's pretty wonderful, actually. You know, the idea of expression, you know, so I train therapists. That's really my educational specialty, and really working with systems and how psychological disturbances and psychological wellness impact systems. So, you know, if we look at education over the years, education can be a demoralizing system insofar as it has limited resources, lack of professional development, which really addresses what you're talking about, is like, how do the teachers learn the skills if they are low on the totem pole, or there's not resources enough to give that professional development. And that's one thing that, I mean, I can just sing the praises of the Santa Rosa City School District, because what I've really seen over the years of being involved with them is a real commitment to responding to this for their teachers. So we've been hired to do retreats and teach about trauma-informed care and have 2 full days with the faculty and the staff to really saturate and marinate in this idea of, you know, changing the way we can be with them and allowing different expressive modalities. So, you know, the introduction of maker classes has just been phenomenal. The mariachi classes are our physical education classes that are really finding ways to give venue for children to
That's so great to hear, because you know how critically movement is connected to brain development. And you know, in many of these schools, public schools that I've been reading and researching about, they don't move. They sit in these seats in rows, and I keep thinking, these people don't know anything about child growth and development, which is another thing, Maria, because what you're doing comes from a basis in humanistic psychology, not in behaviorism.
That's true. And it means a world of difference. I mean, I think that these worlds can, we can collaborate in the school system for an overall wellness climate for children, you know, to help them learn about their behaviors and to help express about their behaviors. And please, do not get me wrong. I totally think that the children at every school I've been, they need more recess. They need to play. It seems like play has become such a mental, digital, visual experience rather than a kinesthetic one. And personally, I am with you. I think that's a huge detriment.
Right. Well, Montessori says that the child's work is play.
You know, totally. And I really see the emotional intelligence that is lost as a result of losing recess. And, you know, at Cook we have a craft class and an art class. Their science and their other classes have maker sections. We have sections of maker classes, which is really wonderful to watch kind of come through the campus. The kids doing, you know, their murals on the available walls and really finding a way to work with restorative. We have a restorative person on campus who's lovely and wonderful, and the students really look to him, and they provide circles and mediation with the teachers or with other children that are having difficulties, and they have accountability and responsibility and circles that are just wonderful and have made a huge difference on campus. Humanidad has instituted a renewal room, and we've now also we're getting ready to bridge with Elsie Allen and bring trauma-informed care now to both campuses so that there's a bridge for our children as they go from one to another campus. And the renewal room is based off of the caring classroom model that's gone through the nation, which is lovely. And there's a great book called Caring Classrooms, and it's got curriculum and how you set it up and the theory and the history, and it's just great. And one of the things that they suggest is that every classroom has a safe space and that children can take time out. And this is all the way, and they suggest this all the way K through 12. Well, when we start looking at some of the older schools, which, you know, Lawrence Cook is, and also we look at the resources that are available, which are not altogether equitable for reasons that are way beyond my understanding, and I wouldn't even attempt to postulate why that is. However, because of the socioeconomic conditions, we don't have the space. We don't have things that are more modern. We're really looking at, you know, from my view, and this, again, is no blame. It's just the understanding of it is that, you know, I think it's really imperative and difficult to really look at implicit bias and the kind of environment that covert as well as overt racism can bring about. And as we look in the educational system also, and I can't speak to this statewide, nationally, or even altogether community-wide, but, you know, we have privilege working with a group of children who do not have privilege, socioeconomic strata. And, you know, my belief is that the those of us that do have privilege because of our skin color, our education, our community, our socio-political economic resources, and the only good thing privilege is for is to help people who don't have it and try and equalize that situation. And I really see the efforts of that in almost every school that I assess and I visit, and I see it on both sides of the coin, too, you know, where it is and where it isn't, and how difficult these, I don't know, systemic issues, and really, I mean, I think that's even understating it. I think it's just a human issue because of the way our minds are programmed, basically, what we take in at the very earliest time. So, you know, it's like really trying to understand it and then teach it so we can all understand it and get off this kind of blame game. So caring classrooms really sets up this environment where children can empower themselves. So it's not like our programs necessarily empower them, but our programs encourage them to take the power that they already have and see where its limitations are and what they need to grow it. So, you know, the renewal room is a non-punitive space where kids can come take time out and be with a friendly adult and do just as you suggest, express. And it also gives us a more immediate interaction with children to get them into counseling and to other support services before they need to act out their need. So that has been profound, because then we are able to say, yes, we see that you need more support here. There is nothing wrong with you. This is not mental illness because you want support. But this is a developmental thing, and this is what's going on with your brain. And so we can express as educators how we understand what's going on, so that the children can then not go into a defensive, reactive mode, so they can take it in. Because if we're blaming them and we're telling them they're stupid or losers or they're not paying attention or they'll never be this or they'll never be that, and all the, you know, somewhat antiquated modalities of trying to control, manage bad behavior, it's just not helping. And
no.
We do what we know. We do what we know.
Yes.
So we need the resources to create professional development so our teachers can have safe space to really look at what they are dealing with, and then teach them alternative models so they can do it different and feel successful.
Yes, that sounds wonderful. And the money, of course, the resources which has been taken, the privatization factions have been milking the cow of public education and taking it away from teachers and students now since 1980. And I'm hoping that, you know, we talked about the political scene. I'm hoping that that will change. I really am hoping that will change soon. Because the children who are at risk, the very ones that you're working with, they're the ones that have suffered the most. Because those people of privilege who live in certain areas, their schools are model. But, people are starting to look. Teachers have been looking. But then, their unions have also been affected, and union busting has also become a part of it, and some of these privatization people have gone into the unions, have taken over the unions. So it's a critical time in public education, and especially a critical time for these students, these young people. And I do find that when using reflective listening in the classroom, if a child yells and stomps their feet, and if you say you're angry, instead of immediately thinking of how to manipulate it, the child will just stop in most cases and just look at you and say, yes. If you're wrong, if they're not angry, they'll say no. But just that you're looking at their behavior and saying, yeah, I understand, just like you would, if your cat is meowing at the place where you keep the food, they're saying, I want to eat. It's the same with children. When they act out and it's so obvious that they're angry or they're hurt or, you're happy. You reflect it, and there's this joy that someone is listening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, therein lies the rub, right? Because if you are not aware that you have an issue yourself, like when we teach parents about parenting classes, right? They say, well, we want our children to do this and this. Go to bed on time, do their homework, be responsible, and quit back talking. And then we listen to how they talk about their children to their children and how they see the child in themselves, then we get insight into why they're power struggling with a 12-year-old. I mean, if you're power struggling with a 12-year-old, it's an indicator that something's going on.
they're little mirrors. They're little mirrors.
And wonderful teachers themselves.
Yeah.
I have to sing praises. I really do. I mean, I've been so, talk about privilege, right? So privileged and so spoiled by having a life career in academia. But it has been one of the most humbling and eye-opening experiences to move into the K through 12 world. And, you know, I say to the teachers all the time, and, you know, they roll their eyes at me, but I don't care. I'll keep saying it. They are everyday heroes, and I don't know how they do it. I mean, you know, I can teach a classroom of 150 students for 4 hours, but 30 kids every hour, 5 times a day, is a whole other ball game, and I have the utmost respect. And I think that, and it's really sad, is it not, that all teachers are undervalued for the complexity and the difficulty of doing a good job for all the reasons that you just named, right? And again, no blame. It's just a systemic process that we are all, you know, we have to keep looking at. I mean, no system is in place and then works forever the same way. It just makes sense that we have to look at things as they grow and change, because we grow and change. We're always in different developmental stages. Why wouldn't it be common sense to think that our modalities also have to change with the times? And
yes.
So, you know, I often hear children say, hey, you can't talk to me like that. And from my view, that's progress.
Yes.
Right? Because yes. They're understanding what it means to hold a boundary and what it means to have some self-respect. And if a 10-year-old has an insight into that, but their 30-something teacher does not, then it can look like opposition.
Yes.
You know, a problem rather than, wow, look how well you know yourself.
Right.
So there it goes. You know, it's like that reflective listening where you just acknowledge what's true in front of you for both of your value, right? For both
yes.
of your benefit. Because the teacher feels good when they see the child, too.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
It's a very complicated issue, though, don't you think? It's not just so simple as one thing or another. And we're talking, like, age old, like you said, you know, back to, you know, way before we were even thinking theory thoughts about anything we did in the classroom.
Right. I feel that we really did know what we were doing in the 60s in education, and we were moving towards this just beautiful culture of education. And of course, that's when university was free in California, as it was in New York. Mm-hmm. And California was second only to New York in education. People came, and they still do, from all over the world to get educated here, because it is so incredible. Teachers come here to get their teacher education and then go back to Finland. And then when we say, why is it so great in Finland? They say, well, we learned it all in America.
Right.
You just stopped doing it in 1980. That's what happened. And so
right.
We do know how to do it. And one of the main reasons that we moved when this all came down, we left a pub. My husband left teaching in Southern California, and we moved up here. And because we had our four sons, and we knew we wanted them to go to a university that had a strong humanistic core, and there were only two institutions left in California mm-hmm. with a humanistic core: UC mm-hmm. Santa Cruz and Sonoma State University.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved specifically so that our sons could go to Sonoma State University. And I'm so grateful for you and for the other teachers that they had there. They got great education there. And I just feel like it's happening at Sonoma, too, that privatization. It's taken longer, but I think it's happening there, too. That's what I've heard. Is it, Maria?
I would say. So I am now emerita, so I retired from teaching at Sonoma State last May because I wanted to really put all of my efforts into Humanidad's venture. I'm still connected with my students there, and I do service learning courses in conjunction with other professors there. But I would have to say that the psych department is still influenced by our history, but and they're still student-centered, of course, and it's different. And for me, I wanted to have a little more freedom to continue the depth of my humanistic and more depth-oriented, you know, indigenous-influenced ways of looking at training therapists and helping students learn about the mysteries of life, rather than focusing so much on behavior and theory. And I guess that would be the biggest thing that I've noticed, right? Because after being on campus for 35 years and starting there at the last years of the human potential movement and some of the big movers and shakers that really influenced my own career, like, you know, James Bugenthal and Virginia Satir and Rollo May and, of course, Carl Rogers and Fritz Perls and all of those, you know, because I'm an old hippie and I came in at the right time in the right place and really kind of live and breathe that kind of humanistic model. And I do see it coming into the school system with more fervor. Our especially with the Santa Rosa district, we our superintendent, assistant superintendent, have deep connections to student-centered, and the principal at Cook also, and Elsie. And so that's very heartening to see. And, you know, with Cook, we have implemented mindfulness, quiet time. We're calling it mindful quiet time. And, you know, it does my hippie heart good as we watch across the nation and around the world schools really taking this trauma-informed care to heart and looking at how to make more meaningful contact with their students and how to encourage them to make more meaningful contact with themselves. And we have seen mindfulness really make a difference. So that the national standards for, you know, implementing mindfulness is, you know, 20 minutes twice a week, doing one class at a time as teachers feel ready. What Cook campus, because they're just a courageous campus that care about their students, and have difficult circumstances, they are doing 2 15-minute discrete periods of mindful breathing, quiet, mindful breathing. And, everybody thought this would never happen. Kids would never be able to do this. Actually, they're great at it. And they do it 5 days a week. And this is the first time in 6 semesters that we have not had the police on campus yet. Knock on wood. We have had very low fighting incidents. There's less referrals. And the teachers, this is what has been just the most awesome is the teachers are more grounded, less frazzled, less anxious, less worried. And I don't mean this is a panacea, and by all means, I mean, we still have rock and roll like any other school. but it's different. And so it's a grand experiment, and so we're all breathing, and we close down. So from 8 to 8:15, no business happens. We close down. We turn off the lights. We lock the doors. And we put signs up saying, we're in quiet time. Mm-hmm. And parents can join us if they come to do business. Anybody that's left in the office when between 8 and 8:15, we shepherd them into our staff lounge where we all do 15 minutes of quiet breathing. And then we do it again at the beginning of sixth period. It's making a difference.
Yes, I know that it's making a difference. I know this because of having had a school, you know, for 20-odd years, and of course, a Montessori school, quiet time, is a part of the curriculum.
Yes, I bet it is.
Yeah, quiet time.
Because it makes sense.
Right, and you know, and silence, you know, and the children, and peace and meditation, and you know, those aren't foreign. Those
are not
foreign in a good curriculum. They're alive and doing well. And mm-hmm. and so I'm just thrilled. I'm just thrilled to hear what's happening there. And it's exciting for me, especially because of the community that it's happening for.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's fabulous. It's really fabulous.
Right. And I also, you know, you talk about being an old hippie. Well, you know, the Mario Savio,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, Berkeley and getting on that car and, you know, his incredible speech there,
mm-hmm.
You know. And then he taught at Sonoma State University.
He did.
And my son Christopher, the youngest, was privileged to be in the last class that he taught, and it was just so meaningful to him. And when he died, it just broke my heart, and I really felt that it was connected to the California putting down the movement, you know, we had passed a bill about you know, making sure that there was equity, you know, and they put that down.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt that it probably broke his heart. I know that's kind of sentimental, but mm-hmm. I can be that way.
But it has its place in the history of things. I mean, you know, I think, well, it's not only sentimentality from my view, Athena, it's also that deep respect that comes with understanding what it means to shepherd something that you deeply believe in, and then have the heartache of watching. I mean, I just think about, you know, Martin Luther King and other people who, I mean,
right.
they must have that deep heartache that, you know, is that is felt when you go, wow, you just don't get this.
Right. Right.
Or are you kidding me? But let me tell you the good news, and I know that we're getting ready to wrap up, but I just wanted to tell you,
we don't have those limits that we had before when Maria has been on Education Now before. In 2011, we did a show together called A Holistic Education, and it was wonderful. But at that time, we were on a public radio, but now this is podcast, and so we don't have those limits, Maria. We can just talk until we're finished.
Okay, great. Well, so let me tell you the exciting news here. So there is a, right now, how this was explained to us is the first time occurrence for the active movement toward equity in the state of California with the California Disparity Act. So the overall state award is indicative of, you know, indeed disparity, because $60 million came to the state the governor, you know, released the money for the state to serve five underrepresented and underserved populations to improve access and equity for public and mental health services for five discrete groups. Well, Latinos, African Americans, lesbian, gay, questioning, Asian, Pacific Islanders, and Latinos. Did I say all five? I think so.
Yeah, indigenous.
Good. I got close anyway. So Humanidad and another local agency. We are the two in Sonoma County that received one of these grants, which is, you know, a five-year, $1 million grant to work on the issues that we are talking about as far as access and equity. And it's a very exciting opportunity. The state is hoping that there's 41 agencies in the state that received these grants, and we work as a cooperative team. We're sharing protocol and process so that throughout the state, these models that are designed, so ours is, you know, education, court-affiliated services, counseling. So, you know, Humani Vad is doing all the counseling at Cook. We're doing a renewal room there. We do the renewal room at Elsie Allen. We're training trauma-informed care at Elsie. And you know, we've really been working from the ground up. So even though our program is a marriage family therapist training program, our therapists are trained into cultural competence and understanding the socio-political, educational aspects that we're working with that hamper mental wellness. And our focus is, you know, all of our developing and really putting the efforts and energy into the agency so that then it can influence the modeling for the state. So they want all of these 41 agencies that have been awarded to cooperate and collaborate and develop a network in the state for replication so that services are more readily available in a social service setting and education. So this is a phenomenal opportunity, and their overall hope is actually for us all to be able to write about what we've done to influence policy. So, you know, there's pockets of, I think, the reignition of, and the recognition, right, of we need to do it different because how we've been doing it doesn't work, and we've forgotten the methods that do work. Because so much of the stuff that does work is also indigenous-based. And all the oral traditions, right? That
yes,
you spend time in nature, you move your body, you know, it's you be with rather than be done to.
Yes.
Right? This is nothing new. It's just coming back to remembering what we've forgotten.
Yes.
Don't you think? I mean,
oh, I do.
It really is that.
I do. Yeah. I do. It's remembering. Mm-hmm. It's, and really, the students will teach us because they remember better. They're closer to it if we would listen. They're
That's
our
really
greatest
true.
Teachers. They really are.
Yeah, they really are. I feel that in my bones for sure. And it's very humbling too. I mean, you know, it's very humbling because it's deep. I mean, I just feel it in every cell. I can feel the disparities, the discrepancies, the joys, the highlights. I mean, it's all so human.
Yes, it is.
Isn't it?
Oh, it is. And is there any opportunity for you to use the Santray, the Jungian Santray therapy with these kids, or is that just too far?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. So really more the Santray work is available to train the therapists.
Mm-hmm.
But we are working with so many children now, so we are starting to implement some sand tray kind of work with, you know, little kid models and working on the floor in a sandbox and things like that. The sand tray itself is pretty phenomenal with children, and it's tough as a therapist training program to find interns and trainees currently in today's idea about what it means to be a therapist. So, you know, in psychotherapy world, behaviorism is also rampant.
Yes.
And so right now, you know, the world of managed care, medications, working with psychiatrists, social workers, and keeping with that medical model is so prominent right now that even finding trainees who want to look at alternative models is a different job than it used to be.
Isn't that amazing? Even though Carl Jung's Red Book must be the most phenomenal success in the world, in our culture, and when it comes to psychology. And how long ago did, you know, how many people have to prove that, you know, behaviorism is just totally off the mark. You know, I mean, you can look at behavior as a tool sort of thing, you know, but to use it to make judgments and then to throw medication at everything instead of looking for the holistic approach and the symbolism, the symbolic language used in a sand tray and in every kind of art and play for children, not just children, but adults as well. As you know, if you read Jung, which I can't even imagine a person who focuses on child growth and development not being conscious of Carl Jung, and those stages of development, the child, the adolescent, then the adult, and then if the adult makes it, wisdom. Mm-hmm. You know, then
right. If all goes well, right?
Yeah, if
but
all goes
know,
well.
So we all, and I really, this is always the challenge, right, is that as the medical model holds so much power in all of our money-making ventures as a culture. So, you know, 15-minute visits with a psychiatrist, and not all, so, you know, I'm not bashing the field that has given me so much, but I do have an opinion, and a professional one at that, which really sees that, you know, in order to, I guess it's probably wrong view in many ways, but the idea that, oh, we can assist more people with this model than the other one because it takes so long, it costs so much money, what good does therapy do, you can't talk away this or that. So the movement to, you know, take a pill and make yourself feel better is just so common in our culture that I don't even think that people think about, oh, maybe I should go to some time at the ocean and really introspect as a viable modality for healing. And, you know, some folks need more than a visit to the ocean, so I'm not oversimplifying some of the complications of mental wellness and retaining mental wellness or achieving mental wellness. And yet, I guess I'm of the view, and it's getting stronger as I get older, I must say, is everything that shows up in our world, having a body, our emotional awareness, our spiritual connection, our ecological connections, are all representative of our inner life and who we are and what we're doing and where our deficits are. And yet people, I think, when they move into fear, when they're frustrated, they can't work, they can't produce, when they're anxious and they're depressed, instead of looking at why they're anxious and depressed, they just want it to stop so they can, you know, feed their families and continue to move ahead. So that's what I mean, is our systemic issues are so big that the only thing that, well, it's not the only thing, but one of the many things, I guess, would be a better way to say it, that really continue to inspire me to do my work is the incremental changes that I see in spite of the overwhelming detriments that present themselves.
Yes.
So, you know, when I watch a 12-year-old whose father was, you know, taken out of their family and nobody knew, he comes home, he's gone, where did daddy go? He was back to Mexico, you need to do this, you need to do that, your world changes. And they still come to school, make their efforts, and they try their 15 minutes twice a day to improve the quality of their life. I am inspired.
They're resilient. They're resilient.
They are. And,
yes.
And we can be too as we learn to heal ourselves.
Yes, and nature is it. Nature, you're right, you know, but nature is the great healer.
It is.
And the Native American indigenous people know that their prayer, what's happening at Standing Rock right now and the pipeline, the Native people are showing us just how important spirit is.
Mm-hmm.
They may actually change this whole conversation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, once again, nature just, you know, I think that that is the problem, is that Western culture has removed itself from nature way back from with the Industrial Revolution, really, and and now they need to make this reconnect with nature, and I think it's part of all of our indigenous my father, who, you know, was only educated to the eighth grade, he knew, and
that's
so it's deep in all of us.
It is. It's deep in all of us, and part of our how we serve each other is to, wherever we can, kind of help each other remember. I really do think that it's just, you know, short-term memory loss on a big social global scale. I appreciate you bringing up what's happening about the waterlands, and I think also what's helped me kind of move through these very tenuous and tempestuous times once again, or maybe even still, is what they say, that, you know, we are the people we have been waiting for.
Yes.
And that strikes me as, you know, a core truth. And I take it very personally, and I see that my students do as well. And I see that some of these teachers, where I go from school to school, I'm enlivened and hopeful, because even though they struggle, they're on the path, and that's incredible. And
yes,
should all be grateful and find ways to support them rather than critique. And, you know, criticize them because they have, what, a summer off, quote unquote.
Right.
The defamation
of the character of teachers has just gone, you know, through the roof. It's so sad. And stress is a killer. You know, stress is a killer. And instead of taking that little pill, it's just a little silence and breathing. Does the trick. Why, that's just something that people need to know.
You know? Yes, it's true. They just need to remember. It's a very rich time, even though it's a pretty frightening time. But, you know, it's just like with every other transformation. You know, sometimes the snake needs to bang itself against the rock to, you know, get rid of the old skin.
Yes.
And this is a rock-banging time, it seems.
It's a rock-banging time. And it's a beautiful day today. I certainly, even though I'm so worried about our world, the political scene, about children and really life, our oceans everywhere, I can't help but notice what a beautiful day it is, and how nature is giving us so much. Mm-hmm. And I can't, and I'm so grateful for this interview. I know what a profound impact you've had upon your students.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes, and I just really want to acknowledge you. And thank you so very much for taking this time, Maria. It's such an honor.
Well, thank you. It's a real privilege. And, you know, I just want to say that I appreciate your acknowledgement. But, I would be remiss to just own it myself, because I have become the teacher I am as a result of the students who have made themselves available to me. So I too have a lot of gratitude.
Yes, but you did get your education during those times our educational system was so supreme.
Yes,
and that's
true.
When Bernie Sanders got his education, and that's when Noam Chomsky got his education. They didn't come from wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Our system created these amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Cazale.
Fortunate time.
Yes, and so we need to preserve it.
I'm with you. It's like with the oral traditions of any successful culture, right? We need to, what you're doing is so valuable, because this is the way that we support and encourage each other, have community and shared dialogue, have informed debate and disagreement, and, you know, really encourage each other to transform and grow and come to our own potential as individuals and communities and society. And Right. All of that.
We're just unfolding.
We are.
Yeah.
You bet.
Well, have a beautiful rest of the day.
Thank you. You too, Athena. I appreciate
it. Oh, I appreciate you so much. And I'll be in touch with you shortly.
Wonderful.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Take care.
You too. That was so much fun for me and so exciting. I thanks again to Dr. Maria Hess. I know her teaching has been a healing experience for so many people. I have such respect for the teachers and staff at Sonoma State University who struggle to keep the humanities as well as the sciences, physics, and mathematics programs thriving under extreme pressure and problems with public education in America today. Please note the Humanidad website can be found on the web just by Googling Humanidad, that's H-U, let's see, here we go, H-U-M-A-N-I-D-A-D, New Multicultural Mental Health Resources. If you just Google that, Humanidad, New Multicultural Mental Health Resources, the website will come up for you. Contact information for us here at Education Now is you can find us on Facebook. Visit our Facebook page and leave comments there. You can find us on the Google Plus. There's a Google Plus Education Now page. You can contact us there. Or you can contact me at Hermes@Pacific.net. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. We are also a proud supporter of the American Montessori Society, and you can find them on the web just by Googling the American Montessori Society. I am sending cosmic love to all, and this is your host, Athena Melville, saying goodbye for now, and in the words of Maria Montessori, reminding you to follow the child.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.